friends, Christy Tagey here, your host for the Productive Passions podcast. Let me ask you, is there something different you dream of doing but don't know where to begin? If you're feeling suffocated, anxious, or you feel there's something different calling you, come along with me for candid conversations with people who have embarked on a journey to put their passions to work for them. Buckle up and enjoy the ride. Life is too short to stay stuck. Hi, friends. Today's episode is all about conquering one of the most common fears we face, public speaking. Here's a statistic I don't think will surprise anyone. Approximately 3 out of 4 people have a fear of public speaking. Yep, that's most of us. Yet at some point, we're likely to be called upon to do just that, whether at work, in our community, a classroom, or even when pursuing our own passions. Today, we're speaking with Lisa Elia, an expert communication coach and consultant. Lisa discovered her passion for communication as a freshman in college, where she began studying communication with a focus on public relations. Later, she translated that into a thriving business in LA. She's worked with clients securing features for them with some of the most prestigious outlets. Maybe you've heard of a few: Oprah, Good Morning America, The New York Times, Forbes, ESPN, to name a few. Now, Lisa has shifted her focus to helping others perfect their pitch and enhance their presentation skills. But it's not all about technique. Lisa emphasizes the importance of preparation and purpose in effective communication. In this episode, she generously shares some of the valuable tips she teaches her clients. Pro tip: pause here if you need to grab your notebooks, because you're going to be given a taste of the secret sauce that can spice up your communication skills. Write these down, practice them, and put them to work for you. According to Lisa, no matter the situation, you will never go wrong if you communicate with clarity, confidence, and compassion. Lisa, welcome, and thank you for being my guest today. I wanted to start out by sharing how we met. I recall meeting you at an event showcasing startup companies when I served as COO for a startup, tech startup. I recall when I met you thinking, she is so well-spoken, gracious, and kind, and exudes a calm self-assuredness that I'd love to possess. I know that you work with people looking to improve their communication for big events, meetings, pitches, interviews. Can you share more specifically about what you do with our audience?
Yes. And first of all, thank you for having me. I'm so happy to be here. And I have to share with you quickly, when I met you, I was so struck by how open you were and friendly and outgoing. And you made my, I was there with my husband, who's a wealth manager. We're both very interested in the tech space, but you made us feel very welcomed. You introduced us to people. And I just, and you seem very knowledgeable and intelligent. And so I'm so happy that we have stayed in touch. So thank you.
Likewise. Thank you for that, Lisa. That really means a lot to me.
And then to tell you what I do, I am a media trainer, presentation trainer, and investor pitch coach, and I provide communication consulting. So my clientele ranges from solopreneurs to huge corporations, C-suite execs. I also work with some professional athletes and actors. It's a big range.
That is a big range. And probably because what you're coaching people to do is something that a lot of us do not feel comfortable doing. That speaking in front of people, especially when it's important, like a pitch, that's where your company may be on the line. What are some of the biggest challenges or hurdles that most people have to overcome for public speaking?
I think the biggest hurdle is overcoming limited or negative labels and beliefs. And most of those were implanted in us in our childhood.
And so negative beliefs, so beliefs that we have about ourselves?
Yes. But it could also be a negative belief about other people or the world.
Interesting.
Right? So yeah, so it could be a lot of things. Sometimes people are told, you know, you're pretty, but not very smart, or the reverse, or it could be, Well, I'll give you an example. One of my clients who is from the Middle East said when he was about 12, he was at a party with his family and he spoke up. And on the way home, his mother said, "Why did you speak? You're not supposed to speak up. You're a child."
And this guy,
he was 12 at the time. And when he talked to me about this, he was probably 50 and on his second huge tech company. So some of these things stay with people until they identify them and then can overcome them. And it's interesting. Most people are unaware of these limiting labels and beliefs that are back there. And then as we talk about them, and I have some exercises I give people to do to discover those and replace those negative thoughts and beliefs with something more positive that's going to help them. And that's probably one of the most important things. I know people think it's about getting rid of fillers and pausing more. All of that helps. But first, what's going to help you is the mindset shifts.
So it sounds to me like you're talking about sort of that reel that plays in our mind over and over again, sort of what we've been told or stereotypes. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. And sometimes it's what you've been told by parents or coaches or teachers, but it could be what you picked up from a friend group or society or playing small. Like some people play small.
And what do you mean by that?
Well, they'll say, well, I just want to remain behind the scenes and that's not really for me. So they're limiting themselves in that way. And it might not be because of something someone else told them, but underneath of it, it might be some fear of failure because maybe they've been taught that things are binary. You either succeed or you fail. And we know life's not like that. It's nuanced, right? You learn lessons. But I think so many of us were just taught things that don't serve us very well. And so we have to reprogram our minds to set us up for success. And the way that comes out the most is in our communication. If people would listen to the way they communicate, they would learn so much about what's inside that they might not be aware of.
So you mentioned you have some exercises. Can you share some of those with us? What can I do to identify what it is I may be doing that's not serving me? And then how can I fix that, Lisa?
So one thing you could do is to do a communication audit. And that would be to record yourself on video. And when you record yourself on video, I wouldn't do it where you're speaking to the camera necessarily. I would do it, just set up a video camera to catch you interacting at home or anywhere you can. And you can also just do that, the audio part too. You want to have both. You want to look at yourself and watch yourself if you want to analyze your communication. You also want to listen to what you're saying. And listen for things like diminishing phrases, such as "I'm just a" or "sort of." All these things that take away from either what you've just said or about to say. That's minimizing yourself. Or when people criticize themselves, "I'm not good at this. I'm terrible at that." Listen for those things. It's really important that you start to identify those things. Or if you overly use quantifying statements like, "Well, I kind of, like I said, sort of, I don't know, what do you think?" Those things all speak to having an external locus of control and value, meaning other people's opinions matter more than your own. And so you want to listen for those things. And that's why I do that with my clients. I listen for those things, but start to keep track of them, write them down. Oh, no, one way to transform that would be write those down and then write next to it in a column, next to those statements that don't serve you well, write the positive. What would serve you better? What would you rather say to yourself? So the negative self-talk, it's not about just eliminating it. It's about replacing it with something positive and watching how you speak to other people about yourself and them. If you find yourself putting other people down, it's often an indication that in some way you might feel inferior or be insecure yourself, because people who feel great about themselves don't need to do that. And so you want to identify what's going on, what's causing this.
So do you think some of that qualifying language that we use might be sort of conditioning what we've learned to do to express humility or to try and be modest?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think we can learn these habits of being subservient through observation or by not wanting to rock the boat, or, and this can be cultural and can be gender specific too. I would say a lot of women, probably over the age of 40, especially, it was a different time. And so a lot of people felt like they had to pull back a little bit to not be considered strident or hard or all these things, right? You couldn't be strong and just be okay with that. And so I'm hoping more and more women will not feel the need to do that. And that's cultural too. In different cultures, people are more overly humble at times.
So it sounds like you're talking about really finding our voice. If we're not naturally, I don't want to say extroverted, but maybe confident, or we have in the past taken that position of, I don't want to sound like I'm boasting. I don't want to sound like I'm trying to be a big deal. It sounds like we need to learn how to communicate that, not that we're a big deal or that we're showing off, but that we're confident.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And sometimes just a clean statement and then letting it sit is all you need to do.
Can you give us an example of that?
Loud. Well, it's just being definitive in an opinion, really, or a statement. I find a lot of people over-explain. Mm. And that's also coming from a place of feeling like your opinion isn't valued enough at times. Sometimes it could be that you might not think people understand what you're saying because it needs more explanation. But just allowing an opinion to sit there and saying, I think we should choose track A because it's going to give us the best ROI. Well, it doesn't mean that you never provide a supporting argument. Sometimes you do want to. There are times you might say, I think we should take track A because it'll give us the best ROI and here are the reasons why. And that's okay, but you don't always have to do that. So it's about knowing who's in the audience. And my perspective is always that your communication should serve the audience. Who are you talking to? What are their goals, needs, fears, challenges, and objections? What's their perspective? And how can you speak so that you are addressing those?
Can you give us a little bit more about that? I really think that that's so important, what you just said. Be sure that your communication is serving your audience. And when you do that and you think that way, doesn't that take the pressure off of yourself a little bit? It's not about you and what you have to do, but what you need to get across to your audience.
The more you make it about them, the easier it is for everybody. First of all, if you do that before you're actually in the conversation or presenting, you will be thinking the right way. You'll be shaping your content so that you are addressing what's in their minds or what they want. And that's always good. And then secondly, in the room, you should be focused on your mission and your message, not on yourself.
I want to switch gears just a little bit and ask you about you, because you didn't get this way overnight.
Absolutely not.
So can you tell me, when you were 10 years old, what did you want to be when you grew up?
Yeah, this is so abstract and bizarre. My friend's mom was like an X-ray technician. I thought, that sounds cool. I want to be an X-ray technician. I really knew nothing about it. I'd had X-rays. I don't know why I thought that. That quickly then morphed into, I want to be a nurse. And then when I learned, like, oh, there's a lot of science and blood and bedpans. That didn't appeal to me. And then I thought I wanted to work with children. And so in high school, I took as one of my classes, child development, psychology, loved those classes. And then my freshman year in college, I just coincidentally or whatever, some luck, my guidance counselor said, why don't you sign up for this small group communication class? And I loved it. And so then I decided I wanted my major to be communication with a PR focus. You did choose a focus. And at the time, we had a small class of only 75 people per graduating class for the whole thing. It was tough to get into, but it was really an amazing education. However, I only had one public speaking class in my curriculum. Most of it was focused on strategy and the psychology behind it and writing press releases and very practical work, but only one public speaking class. And they didn't teach most of what I teach my clients. There was nothing about mindset or controlling nerves. And it was a different time, frankly. It was a long time ago.
So what was your journey like? How did you end up being able to teach other people about that when you only had one class yourself?
Well, fortunately, we did have a good foundation in communication. So the nonverbal communication, verbal communication. However, what happened for me was when I was 27, I had my own little marketing communications firm that I'd started. A friend called me and said, can you fill in for me in 2 days and do this 1 hour presentation on how to create a marketing plan for your small business at the University of Delaware? And that was my alma mater. Gosh. And I agreed because I thought, well, maybe I can get some business out of it. I don't know. But I had 2 days to put together a 1 hour presentation in practice, and I didn't really know what I was doing. So I was so nervous. I had this shaky paper in my hand, but I did all right enough. They asked me to come back a month later. And so I dedicated a lot of time and focus to finding out what goes on in the body. Why do we respond that way when we're nervous? I started taking acting classes and voice and movement for non-dancers. I just plunged into it because I knew I wanted to be a better speaker. I went back a month later and it went great. And I committed to really practicing and also just having a good time with the audience. And it went so great. I got a whole bunch of clients from it. And then I did that for a while. And every time I got clients. And so that was many years ago. I was 27, so decades ago. And so I just continued to learn and develop my skills as a speaker. And then I media trained some of my clients even when I was living in Delaware, but really I didn't start doing it fully until I was in LA and had a PR firm there. And clients just, I would media train them. Then they would say, oh, can you also help me with this speech? Can you also help me with his investor pitch? So I dove into what it takes to pitch to investors and learned all about that. And now I've helped clients raise millions of dollars, but it was a journey and it's a continuous journey. I never stop learning ever. And I don't think people should in their field of study.
So I want to go back to something you talked about. You said you took an acting class.
Mm-hmm.
What was it that you learned in acting that helped translate to communicating and getting your point across? Not just getting your point across, but influencing.
I would say the most important thing I learned in acting, and it was several classes, but I studied at HB Studio in New York, which is a really great acting school. So Uta Hagen had founded it. She'd been on Broadway and in films. In her book, and even in the classes, they taught you how to prepare, a preparation ritual. Some of what I teach my clients came from that, a few pieces. But that's when I really discovered how important it is to have a preparation ritual. And it's something most of us were never taught. We were like taught, hey, go do a book report, get up there, great. No prep, right? No feedback, nothing. And so that preparation ritual has been pivotal for me and many of my clients to manage nerves, to get you focused and centered. And so that bit, the piece that I learned from acting class, I'd say was really important. That was part of it. And then also being fully present in the moment, super important, because a lot of people have like this external second person looking at them, criticizing them. That's not helpful. You want to be very fully in your body and in your mind and connected to who you're talking to and your content. So those are things that come from good acting classes and really excellent teachers, which I had. I'm very grateful for that experience.
Yeah, it seems obvious that you've grown from there. Can you tell me, what does a preparation ritual look like? What might that include?
The one that I lead people through includes some breathing to manage the nerves, because when people get nervous, their bodies can go into fight, flight, or freeze, and we want to stay out of that. So some breathing, there's some movement. You want to warm up parts of your body, especially the upper body, some vocal warm-ups, even some facial warm-ups to warm up the lips and mouth so you're not tripping over your words, and definitely some mindset pieces, extremely important.
How long is that ritual? Is that like 5 minutes? Is it like 30 minutes? How long should we dedicate to preparing for our big conversation, interview, presentation?
Okay, so for the preparation ritual itself, if you do it all together, it takes me longer to teach, but to do it takes maybe 3 minutes. And I made it short on purpose, because if it's too long, people won't do it.
Sure.
Especially my clients, they're really busy, C-suite execs, you know, they're not going to do something too long. And so that's something you do right before you rehearse and before you go on. And I had one client who said, I'm going to do this before I go into the office every day, because he felt so much better. It just shifted how he felt. And so that is important. Prior to that, though, you should be rehearsing your content. If you know you're going to be delivering a presentation or a pitch or being interviewed by the media, you should be rehearsing, not verbatim. but practicing delivering your content. So it's really in you and you can deliver it with emotional connection to what you're saying. So those things combined are what's going to really help. Because if you go in, even with the prep ritual, if you're not ready, you're going to panic probably if you don't feel prepared.
What about for first timers? I know after you've done it a little while, you gain some confidence, but that first time doing your big presentation, what are some things that can help just settle us down in the moments just before sort of going on?
Well, that's a good preparation ritual. That really is what it is. The biggest part is starting with the breathing in and diaphragmatic breathing in through your nose for a count of five, filling the diaphragm, hold for a count of five, out through the mouth for a count of five. That stimulates the vagus nerve and that switches you from the sympathetic to parasympathetic part of your nervous system. The parasympathetic is the calm part. Sympathetic is the fight or flight part. And so that is one of the most important things you can do.
Okay, a count of five in, hold for five, mm-hmm. and exhale, but in through your nose.
And then hold.
And out and through your mouth. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I do that a few times. It really does help. That's just part of it. I mean, the whole ritual would take a little longer to explain, but having a prep ritual. Also, doing some cardiovascular exercise the day of, like the morning of, anything is always going to help you. It'll help you feel sharper mentally and get rid of some of that nervous energy. And if you can't do that, even just 10 minutes makes a difference. But if you can't do that, just take a little walk. Even that can help to calm your nerves. What you don't want to do is be spinning and thinking about what if, what if, what if. The fear of fear can be paralyzing.
And you're right. I think what for me personally, one of my biggest challenges is exactly that, the fear of fear. Mm-hmm. I'll share a quick little story about I went skydiving, and the entire time I was waiting to be horribly scared. I was anxious about being fearful. Mm. Literally, until it was my time to jump out of the plane, I got to that door and I was like, oh my gosh, this is going to be all, I'm going to feel terrible. This, we jumped out and it was amazing. So I missed half of the experience, probably more of the experience, mm-hmm. waiting to be afraid. Mm-hmm. So if I had, you know, the experience of a preparation, even before that, to have been able to do that ritual, I probably would have enjoyed the whole experience. And I think that's what you're talking about is not just getting out and spewing what you need to say, but really being present, like you said, but you can actually enjoy it. Am I right?
Yes. Yeah. And if you're talking about things you're not passionate about, you should question why that is. Are you in the wrong field? You know, because you should like what you're talking about. If you're pitching a product, for sure, you better love that product. I mean, some people are in sales and say, oh, I could sell ice to an Eskimo. And I think, okay, you're just telling me to not trust you, basically. But for most people, we want to feel passionate about whatever we're doing. And so connecting to that emotionally. And also, even if you're talking about something as dry as numbers, there's some emotional connection there too, or there should be. Because if you think about what those numbers mean, for example, if you have an up quarter and you made more money, that might mean somebody's kid gets to go to college because they're going to get a huge bonus. So the numbers mean something. And so when you talk about them, the more you connect emotionally to what you're talking about, the more that's going to come across and the more interesting you'll be and the more captivating.
So you talk about needing to be passionate about what you're talking about. And that's what this podcast is all about. Is doing what you're passionate about. So I was going to ask this a little bit later, but now is as good a time as ever. What's your advice for people who feel like they're stuck, that they are not passionate about what they do, but their job demands them to talk about it or present about it or just show up every day? What advice do you have for someone who wants to get unstuck, for lack of a better term?
You can find the passion and find the love in different ways for whatever you're doing. So sometimes it might be, hey, this job gives me great security and insurance coverage, and that's what I need right now. that you can attach emotionally to that in a way, if that's where you are. There are times we've all had survival jobs, or many of us have had survival jobs, and you just make the most of it. And the more you do that, if you think of it this way, you're developing skills that you're going to take with you for life. And when you show up fully at whatever you do, you're just a great performer, and that can open up other opportunities for you too. In fact, I'm going to give you an example. I was at, this was years ago, and I'll never forget this young woman. I was at the Verizon store in Santa Monica getting a new phone. And the young woman who helped me was amazing. Oh, here's what had happened. My phone broke the day before we were going to go fly back east for Christmas. You need a phone. Like, every, you know, it was just not good. Yeah. And so she did do all this stuff, and I had insurance anyway. She handled everything so beautifully. And I said, you just have a great personality. I'm sure somebody's going to offer you a job someday. She said, well, I have to tell you, this is my last day. I'm starting a new job on Monday from somebody who came in here who was a customer. You could just see it. And so when you show up at your best, that's the thing. You're doing it partly for you. So find that. Challenge yourself. If you don't love what it is you're doing at the moment, challenge yourself to present it as well as you can so you can develop your skills. It's not even about that.
I love that story. And I'll share with you, I spoke to a friend recently who teaches, and she really was getting discouraged and frustrated with teaching. And she said, you know what, Christy? I have rekindled my love of teaching. It was about perspective, but she had to recognize that she was frustrated, give herself grace and understand why she was feeling frustrated. But she said, you know what? I just remembered why I liked being a teacher. And then she actually started doing some very creative things in the classroom that made her excited about presenting the material, and her students really responded to that. So I don't think that it's always about having to change what you're doing. Sometimes it is rediscovering why you fell in love with this in the first place. Or to your point, maybe it's providing what you need to have in the moment so that maybe in the future you may move on to something else or get promoted, move to another area of a company and be able to enjoy what you're doing. I do think it's really important to be able to find the joy in what you do, because we spend a third of our life working. That's so much time. Right. And it really impacts everything else in our lives, including the people that are around us. So lots more to dive in there. But I want to ask you about your move to LA. Delaware to LA.
Well, I was in New York, though, before LA, for just like a year.
That's still a really big move. What made you decide LA? And what did your family and friends say when you told them, hey, I'm moving to LA. I'm going to start a PR firm in LA.
Well, I was always a lover of warm weather. I've always loved warm weather. And when I was little, I kind of forgot about this. When I first moved to LA, my dad said, you always said you'd move to California or Florida someday. I just do not like the cold. I don't do well there. And so that was part of it. But also, I felt like I just sort of had an instinct that it would be a better fit for me in terms of everything, the culture, everything. And I wasn't sure I was going to even stay in PR, frankly. I was not sure. So I moved there. I was doing a little bit of acting, but I thought, well, let me see what I want to do here. And I temped for this woman who ran a real estate agency, and she loved me. And she said, because I already had my own business, so I knew what I was doing about with administrative things. She said, can we hire you to run the office? Do you want to be our office manager? I said, no, it was a good salary, but it wasn't what I wanted to do. So she called me a couple weeks later and said, my friend is a fitness trainer, a celebrity fitness trainer, and she just needs some help getting organized. Can you go help her out for a couple days? So I went to work with Valerie, and she had this like 2-inch thick business plan sitting on her desk. And I said, you know, I've written business plans before. Do you want me to look at that? And I looked at it, and I think she'd used a computer program to generate it. So it just was not right. And so I rewrote her business plan. We ended up getting the loan. She needed a loan to start these muscle truck fitness companies. I got her trademark. I did all this stuff for her. I wrote, and in the business plan, I wrote that we wanted to get her into all these major magazines at the time. That was a big deal. you know, back in the 90s.
Right.
And that she would have, I wanted her to be a contributing editor to a major fitness magazine and write a book. So she was laughing when she read this, but within 6 months, I had her in all these major magazines, just so many. And within about a year, maybe a year and a half in, she had two offers to be a contributing editor. And so she took one of them. And that meant she couldn't do any more outside press. She also did have a book offer, but she didn't want to write a book at the time. She decided not to do that. So everything we wrote in, she was like, that was magic paper. And so I had built her up, but then I had already, that helped me establish myself in LA as a publicist who could really make things happen. And so her office was in this gym with all these other celebrity trainers. And even 15 years later, I'd get calls from people that say, I heard about you from, it used to be Workout Warehouse. They changed it to Fitness Factory, but people would still call me saying, I heard about you from there. But that launched my business. It really did. So then when she couldn't do any more outside press, because she got that contributing editor job, I wrote on a piece of paper, reduce hours with Valerie, earn more money, take on more freelance work. And 2 days later, this woman came up to me in the locker room and said, I'm ready to launch my reflexology socks. Can I hire you? And that was Michelle Kluck, now Michelle Eben, who became one of my amazing clients, referred me to so many people within 2 weeks. I was able to give notice. I waited a month to leave because I wanted to wrap things up properly, but that built my entire business. And I didn't even have a website for like years. It was just all.
Well, wait, you wrote down three things? What were those things that you wrote down?
Reduce hours with Valerie, pick up more freelance work, earn more money. It was really simple.
So is that, was that for you sort of like what we talk about vision boards are?
Yes. You know, I read creative visualization, gosh, years ago. And I, even when I wanted to move from New York to LA, I just wrote May 1st, 1996, I will move to Los Angeles. And I did. You know, I really do believe, and it's not always that magical and that precise, but I am a big believer in writing out specifically what you want to achieve. And it may or may not look exactly like that, but it's going to get you moving toward that goal.
And that's something that's gained more popularity. Like I said, with the vision boards or stating an intention, what is it about writing it down or saying it out loud or creating a vision board, something to look at, that helps translate into real world? Any idea?
Well, visualization, and that is one of the things I do recommend that people do on a daily basis, is visualize yourself becoming a more confident, powerful speaker, and literally visualize yourself doing that. Visualization has been proven to be useful. Athletes use it before they can accomplish anything. They have to visualize themselves doing it. Mm-hmm. So visualization, there's just lots and lots of studies about why that works. That's why vision boards are helpful for people. And affirmations can also be useful, but I think you want to do them the right way. Like if I said something that I feel is too pie in the sky, like I'm the best speaker ever, that would not feel real to me. But if I say something like, I'm becoming a more powerful, effective speaker every day, first of all, it's not comparative, which is good. I don't like comparing to other people. I don't think that's great. But it's also something that is active. I like active affirmations. And then you can have some that are goal-oriented, like I will be living in this place by this time. But then the key is, if things don't turn out that way, you don't want to feel deflated, like, oh no. You want to look at, okay, what else has come up that's present in my life? Maybe there's some other good changes or you're getting there.
What I like that you said was, in your affirmations, make them active. There's so many really great quotes and things that you could put up. But I think that makes the responsibility, that puts the responsibility on me if I make it action-based. Is that part of why that can be successful? Because then the shift isn't to some big thing out there, but to what I'm going to be doing.
Yes.
What is the most exciting or unusual part of the work that you do?
You know, I love what I do. There is never a day when I have to meet with a client that I think, oh, I don't want to do this. Never.
Really? Ever, ever.
No, I love what I do. Of course, there are parts of running a business that are like, you know, taxes and whatever. That part isn't fun. But I really do love what I do. I even love doing the research to prepare for working with the client and helping them define their messaging. But when I get to experience people having those epiphanies and letting go of something that's been weighing them down, that's holding them back, that shift, because I know that's beyond my work with them, that's going to translate into everything they do. That to me is the biggest thrill. When I see people lightening their emotional load, of course, it's very gratifying to see somebody who didn't speak very well at the beginning, perhaps, become a more eloquent, clear speaker. But I think the internal shifts are the biggest.
When you see that internal shift happening, is that sort of the pivotal moment for other things to start happening? Is that like the dominoes or the cascading effect?
Yes, absolutely. When people get more comfortable with themselves, they become more comfortable with pausing. That then allows them to pause when they need a moment to think, which also means they'll probably use fewer filler words like and ah. So you look at all the benefits of just that one mental shift. It's huge.
That is huge.
Taking up space is a big thing in this world, and a lot of people are afraid to do it physically, and they're afraid to do it with pauses and taking time in a meeting. I've had clients say, yes, when it's my turn to speak, I usually rush through because I don't want to take up too much time. So those are lessons we can learn. And look at the most powerful people. They'll take their time.
Well, we're uncomfortable with those silences, right?
And why is that?
Why is that?
Well, I think it's a few things. One is people sometimes don't like all that attention being on them because they're too worried about what other people think and that other people are critiquing them. When you let go of worrying so much about what other people think of you and you just go do your best and leave it at that, and then you can't worry about the filters through which people see you, that's going to bring you some peace. And then you're okay with people just staring at you. It's okay. That's part of it. And then part of it is feeling worthy enough to take up somebody's time and be respectful of people's time. So if you're going to take people's time, make sure there's a reason and it's worth it.
You know, I think you hit the nail on the head, especially for me in that second one about rushing through, rushing, because you don't want to take too much of somebody's time. You want to be mindful of their time. So you want to hurry up and get through everything. Mm-hmm. But it would seem the way you come across in doing so is maybe less confident, less organized, less prepared mm-hmm. than if you're able to present and be comfortable in those silences.
Right. Absolutely. Everything you just said is so right. The other thing is that when you pause, you're giving people an opportunity to think and take in what you're saying, and to make the connection between what you're saying and how that applies to them or how they will implement that in their lives. So pauses are like the negative space around an item when you want to photograph something. Like if you want to photograph this phone that I'm holding up, you need some space around it to focus on the phone. That's what pauses do in our language. They leave some space around the main points that people need to grasp.
So how do we practice those pauses?
In your everyday life, in every conversation you have, get used to not using all those fillers, like, you know, I mean, try to get rid of those and pause when you need a moment. Or if you've been talking for a while, pause.
In an article, you were quoted as saying, know the ROI of everything you do. Mm-hmm. How can we be more aware of where and how we're spending time? Is there a technique that you recommend that we could put into practice?
I'd say the first thing would be get very clear on your core values and your goals. What do you value? Is it time with your family, time with your significant other, travel, whatever it is, money, whatever it is for you, get very clear on what your core values are. And then anytime you have a task or an offer or an opportunity, look at, does this move me closer to where I want to be or further away from it? I'd say that's one of the easiest ways to do it. And then also think, when I think about ROI, your return on investment, of things you do, really look at that. It's good to analyze, okay, if this is going to take me 5 hours, is it worth me doing, or should I hire somebody to do it? Or can I get away with not doing this or doing it a different way? So it is important to analyze that for certain tasks. I used to, when I was in PR and I had a lot of young entrepreneurs as my clients, I had a little worksheet for them to just list all the tasks they had through the day and write and make a mark of what they enjoy, what they don't, how long things take. It really reveals to you how you're spending your time. And some things have a high ROI and some things have a low ROI. So you have to decide, what do I want to spend time doing? If you need total control over everything, you're going to limit your growth.
Okay, so there is always a point in my interviews where I want to hit rewind and play it again. And I love what you just said. Would you say that again?
If you need total control over everything, you will limit your growth.
From your observations working with hundreds, maybe thousands of clients, what are some of the things that many of us are doing wrong?
I would say a few things. One is not being super clear on your intention before beginning a meeting or a conversation. Secondly, I think in business, sometimes people don't research their audiences enough. And thirdly, I would say, I mean, it goes back to the mindset. Letting fear of judgment and all these external things come into play instead of really focusing on the mission and the message. And I do think with intention, one of the intentions as much as possible should be to preserve the relationship. Even in business, even in negotiation, some people think they want to go burn it all down. I do not think you ever want to do that if you can avoid that. And so when you go in thinking, I want to preserve this relationship and we want to achieve these goals, we want to do this, want to understand from their perspective. And if you enter any situation with curiosity and empathy, that shifts how you behave.
There it is again. I want to hit rewind. Curiosity and empathy. Why is that important?
If instead of just grinding on what you want, you're actually thinking about what the other people want, what their needs are, what they're focused on, you're going to have a deeper and better conversation. So that's empathy, not sympathy, empathy, right? You're understanding where they're coming from. Curiosity helps because when you ask questions and you go in thinking that that's your job is to learn what they want and how you can maybe navigate and negotiate if that's what you're doing, you'll just be that much more effective. And it's also, it puts people more at ease when people think you actually care and are interested in what they want in any situation.
What that sounds like to me is making sure the person you're communicating with feels heard.
Yes, absolutely. And sometimes you have to ask questions to elicit some of that participation from certain people in certain situations.
One of the things I've seen in sales, especially with new salespeople, is they're so good at repeating what they've learned, the values and the benefits of what they're selling. And so they're spending a lot of time getting that all in. But what they haven't gotten is allowing that person to feel heard. They're not giving the person that they're talking to, that they're selling to, the feeling that they've heard what they're saying, what their pain points are. And I really feel like, and based on my experience, the people that end up making the sale aren't the slickest talkers.
Right.
But they're the ones who have create an environment where the person they're speaking to feels heard, has had the opportunity to really communicate, not just respond, but to communicate what their concerns are around whatever that deal is. If you could give advice to a new salesperson, what are some of those things besides making sure somebody feels heard? You talked about body language. Mm-hmm. What are some of the things that they could take with them to a sales call that they really should be thinking about?
A few things. One is body language changes from one society to another. It also shifts with the times. For mm-hmm. example, before COVID, pretty much everybody shook hands in business. Some people don't want to anymore. Right. A lot of people, especially in LA, would hug. Some people don't want to anymore. So now some people ask permission. Hey, do you want to shake hands? Or it's different. It's kind of awkward to ask this permission for something that felt so second nature before mm-hmm. this. So that's one body language shift to make, is being cognizant of that. How does this person feel now about that? You might even ask before you jump right in. So that's one thing. And you know, body language, there's a lot to say there, but I would say you always want to have an open body language, not aggressive. So you don't want to be leaning too far into somebody. That's proxemics. You're invading their space. You're talking about the space between people and how people use space. So I think that's something to look at. Certainly mirroring can be overdone, where people go, oh, well, he crossed his arms, so I crossed my arms. Then I uncrossed it. People can sometimes feel that. You might mirror somebody's behavior naturally, but if it's very overt, people can sometimes feel it and it feels unnatural and they won't know why, but on some level, they're not going to trust you.
You said, don't allow your creativity to tempt you away from your real work. Mm-hmm. Boy, this hits close to home. I catch myself at times being distracted from my work with my creative side.
Uh-huh.
What do you mean when you say this? And how do we keep those creative juices flowing without them becoming distractions?
It's funny. I'm thinking, wow, she dug deep for some of these things. That was probably a long time ago. I would say it's important to make time for your creative endeavors. And if creative ideas come to you when you're supposed to be working, write them down, capture them somewhere, and then make a time to go look at them again. Because that's, I think, what people feel or fear is that, oh no, I have this great idea. If I don't act on it right now, it's going to leave. But if you do a quick brain dump into a document or whatever it is, into your phone, just spew it out, that's going to help you get that out and save it and literally put in your calendar, like on a Saturday or time, whenever you have time, look at this idea in this place. That can free you up to then refocus on work. I've just seen many people, when I wrote that, I was working with some clients who were very creative and they just wouldn't get their work done. Oh yeah, this happened. It was shiny object syndrome. So they were just going off on all these tangents and they were never getting closer to what they wanted to do. And so there is some discipline required to succeed in anything.
I really like that, because when I read that, I thought, oh no, I can't give up my creative side. That's the side of me that I really like. But I like that. It's like, hold on to it, but keep doing what you need to do right now.
And you do want to capture those ideas when they come, because they might not come back. Writers will tell you that. That's why they walk around with little notebooks or their phones capturing ideas as they come. Definitely capture your ideas.
You said commit to systems that promote your business. How can I incorporate this advice if I don't know anything about promoting a business?
Well, we live in the wonderful age of the internet. So there are just so many ways to promote your business. It's good to learn about various ways, whether you want to pursue promoting yourself on social media, through publicity, buying ads, whatever that is, research different things, find out what speaks to you, and then literally create systems and have in your calendar that you're going to work on. Okay, if I'm going to commit to getting some publicity, I'm going to reach out to some outlets with some ideas and set aside time to do that, and then just create a system for that. And then within this system, you're going to have mini systems, like keeping track of who you've reached out to, what you pitched to them, when you followed up. All those things.
So it's choosing how you're going to do it, mm-hmm. what works for you, what feels comfortable for you. But then the second part of that is committing to the action.
Yes.
And being consistent with that. Did I get that right?
Yes. And consistent might not always mean regular. There are times you might do a huge push for something and then you might be tied up for 3 months and literally not have any time to work on something else, or it just might not be the right time. So you might promote something, take a few months and not, and then promote something else. Just depends. Like, I always have Google Ads running for my business, and I've gotten amazing clients from around the world from Google Ads. It's just how people discover you. And then also I did some SEO. It's funny, I bought a $97 course years ago from Natalie Lussier, I think is how she pronounces it, on how to do SEO on your website. And I still rank pretty high, my website does, for certain terms. So those are two things that I always have going, right? And so you have to figure out what's going to work. But yes, I always have ads going. That is one of my constant systems. So find some ways to promote your business that you can keep up with. And if you don't love doing it, maybe decide you're going to outsource some of that. Because it's hard to run a business without promoting it at all. Right. Very rarely can they just sustain themselves. Right.
Well, that goes back to your ROI, right? If it's not something you're comfortable with, or you don't feel like you don't know enough about, that might be the piece of your business that you outsource. Is there a mantra that you call to mind when things are difficult?
This is only temporary.
Mm.
Because life is temporary, first of all. It just is. And most situations really are that. I think people get stuck and think, oh, I'm going to feel like this forever. Most things are not.
So interesting in the conversations that I've had with people who are following their passions. There are certain things that are consistent, mm-hmm. and that is one of them. Because you're going to run into those stumbling blocks, right?
Right.
But it's in the moment. And it may be hard, but you'll get through it with persistence.
Mm-hmm.
But it's temporary.
Right.
And the other thing that goes along with what you just said, is so is life.
Yeah.
So if you need to put something into perspective, life is not infinity.
Right.
The way we know it now, anyway. And so when these challenges feel so overwhelming,
mm-hmm.
I think that's a really good mantra. That's a really good reminder. And it might be a place that we can take a breath.
Yeah.
Thank you for that.
You're welcome. You know, what you were saying about life and it being temporary, it is. And I think if you approach life every day knowing this could be my last day, this could be my last moment, because at any time, that's true. I know to some people that sounds very dramatic. And I think, well, you must have been fortunate enough to not lose a lot of people in your life. For myself, that was not the case. I lost 3 cousins when I was young. I lost 3 very good friends within about 2 years in my 20s. And that was, one was to a car accident, 2 weeks later, a suicide. And then I think a year before that was AIDS. You know, that was when people died of AIDS still. And, you know, readily. When you lose people like that at a young age, I think you don't think that dying is just for old age. You realize things can happen at any moment. And so the gift on the other side of that is that for me, made me very acutely aware of being very conscious of the beauty of being fully present in the moment as much as I could. And I had to get rid of some of the mind garbage that I've had to work through to get to that place. But I do spend a lot of my time so fully present in the moment that I really enjoy my life. And no matter where, I tell people, talk to people when you're out at the store. You never know. Like I met my husband at Trader Joe's, totally random. That would not have happened if I wasn't in the right mindset, I don't think.
Right.
Right. So we were just enjoying a moment, two strangers. And now almost 20 years later, we're still together. So.
Oh, that is a great story.
Yeah, that's life though. It can be. You have to still remain optimistic and think, okay, there's a big world out there. What can I create? What can I do? How can I have tomorrow be a completely different day? Especially here in the US, we're very fortunate. There's a lot of opportunity. And so the optimism is part of it. This is temporary. There's an optimism that's a part of that.
Lisa, what is your favorite thing in the world?
Favorite thing? Ah, I don't know if I have just one.
I'm going to pause and give you time to think about it.
Things to do. I do like to travel. I love talking to people, frankly, as you can probably tell. I like meeting new people. I always have. I always like learning. I definitely like the sunshine. Seriously, just being outside when it's sunny and warm. That never gets old to me. We look at the sunsets all the time. We live in Florida now, and the sunsets are crazy amazing here. And we have a good view of them. And really, my husband and I still will go, if we're not together when it's happening, if one of us is working out, we'll call each other and go, hey, look outside, look at the sun, look at it. So I think that I take so much joy from so many things. There's not just one favorite thing.
And isn't it amazing that those things, travel is an exception, of course.
Right.
But enjoying nature, it doesn't cost a thing.
Right. Oh, yeah. We laugh because the things I enjoy are often cheap and often free. And that's okay. I really don't care about luxury items. But yeah, I get a lot of pleasure from being outside, seeing the cute dogs in the dog park, walking by and seeing the funny kids play together. Just, I love it all. So I think there's, when you can get joy from those simple things, your life is a lot easier because you're not waiting for the big things.
Right. And I know it's so cliche to say, but it's true. If you can enjoy those things, you really are one of the most wealthy people in the world. My husband and I talk about that a lot too. You know, we think, oh, it'd be fun to have this. It'd be fun to have that. But you know what? Having those things does not change my happiness quotient.
Right.
I've had very little in my life, and I've had not a lot, but I've lived a more comfortable life. And who I am, my happiness quotient hasn't changed. What right. makes me happy hasn't changed. Yes, there may be excitement in that new whatever, mm-hmm. but seeing one of my kids come home excited to tell me about something or a mm-hmm. grandchild reach up for me. Those are the things that just yeah. bring me so much joy. And I'm so grateful for that because I don't need any money for that.
Right. Now, I will say, you know how people say money doesn't buy happiness? I agree with that to a point. There is a certain level, though, that if you're scraping by all the time yes. and always behind, that level of stress really is a lot. So for anyone who's listening, if that's where you are, you know, yes, get yourself out of that as soon as you can. And it's understandable if you're not feeling super joyful all the time, but do try to put some joy into your life when you can and make a plan to get out of that. Because you do have to have a certain level of comfort knowing that certain bills are paid or whatever that is, or you're not going to lose your home in order to be open to the other things, be open to moving on. But yeah. people do it. People do it. My family came here with nothing. One of my cousins came over here at 18. It's actually my cousin's husband. He was 18. He said, I had a pair of underwear and $12. And that was it. And some really good carpentry skills. And he retired a multi-millionaire, just so successful. All built himself. Didn't know the language, nothing. So we have a lot of those stories in my family. So you can, no matter what, you can get out of it, especially here in the US or certain countries. There are some countries where people really have no opportunity, but we do have some here. So get the help you need, find the way out, and get that mindset working for you, not against you.
Lisa, thank you for joining me today. It's been such a pleasure having you on the podcast.
It's been my pleasure, Christy. Thank you so much.
If somebody wanted to reach you, how can they reach you and where can they learn more about you?
You could go to lisaelia.com. Everything is there. I'll be introducing some online courses soon. Probably by the time this comes out, some will be available. And there's a lot of information on my full service work there as well. And my blog feeds right into that as well.
Okay, so the place is Lisa Elia, all one word, LisaElia.com.
Right.
And we'll have that in the show notes as well. Again, Lisa, such a pleasure. Thank you so much.